Welcome to The Social Science of War, a podcast for the Army or Land Warfare professional. My name is Kyle Atwell. I'm an Army officer currently instructing international affairs at the Social Sciences Department at West Point. And in today's episode, I'm joined by three experts to discuss what lessons the United States Army should take from the war in Afghanistan, and whether it's making the effort to capture those lessons sufficiently, given a pivot and focus to strategic competition. My guest experiences with Afghanistan range from the highest levels of U.S. government to the most tactical level of implementation on the ground, as well as a scholar who has studied and published widely on both Afghanistan and counterinsurgency more broadly. First, retired Lieutenant General Doug Lute has held a long and distinguished career in public service, which includes serving as the Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan under President George Bush, Special Assistant and Senior Coordinator for Afghanistan and Pakistan under President Obama, and then as the United States Permanent Representative to NATO. Dr. Jason Lyle is an Associate Professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth University. He has conducted fieldwork in Afghanistan as a scholar, published extensively on counterinsurgency and conflict in fragile states, and is currently writing a book on lessons learned from the American war in Afghanistan. Our third guest is Major Sam Wilkins, an active duty U.S. Army Special Forces officer currently teaching international affairs in the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. He deployed to Afghanistan during the surge as an infantry lieutenant, has multiple deployments to Africa, and has published multiple articles on Afghanistan and irregular warfare more broadly. The Social Science of War podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. Our goal is to bring together experienced soldiers and scholars to better understand land warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. We hope you enjoy today's conversation with Doug, Jay, and Sam. Ambassador Doug Lute, Professor Jay Lyle, and Major Sam Wilkins, welcome to Season 1, Episode 4 of the Social Science of War podcast.
Kyle, it's good to be with you.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kyle. It's great to be on today.
Today, we're going to talk about the lessons the Army should take from Afghanistan. There's a lot of excellent commentary and scholarship out there reflecting on the 20-year war, and for good reason, given the immense cost and investment made in the conflict. What makes this conversation a little unique is specifically looking at lessons for the Army. But before we get to these lessons, I'd like to motivate the central question a little more. We can start with Doug. What impact has Afghanistan had on your career? And what role do you think the lessons from Afghanistan will play for an army that is now primarily oriented on how to engage in strategic competition and increasingly focused on large-scale combat operations?
Afghanistan has been a central theme for the last 10 years of my 40-year career in the government, having left the government in 2017. And for that entire 10-year period, I was focused on Afghanistan, sometimes alongside focusing on Iraq, which is part of the story here. But that last 10 years was largely focused on Afghanistan. And to the second part of your question, Kyle, I think it's too soon to tell what impact Afghanistan is going to have. And I hope that podcasts like this can actually spark the debate, which I think is questionable, whether the military, whether the Department of Defense, whether the State Department, the U.S. government, but in particular the Army, will have the courage to actually look back on this 20-year war, do the forensics on it, and learn from it. So hopefully we can take a small step forward today.
Yeah, so it's been an enormous part of my career as well. My career is not anywhere near as illustrious as the ambassador's, but I was an accidental person in Afghanistan. I was a Russianist by training and was kicked out of Russia due to my work on insurgency in Chechnya, which we don't need to get into in this podcast. But I had a friend who was serving in the U.S. Army and invited me over in 2009. And so I spent the summer of 2009 going through counterinsurgency training center out at Camp Julian, just south of Kabul. And I fell in love with the country and also thought I could maybe make a difference on the margins, at least using some of the social science skills that I had learned as a PhD student and had now worked with the Army, USAID, Mercy Corps, with various Afghan organizations in a variety of different functions. And so I too hope that we have a sustained conversation about whether Afghanistan is relevant for today for Ukraine. I'm worried we're not going to have that conversation. I'm worried that there isn't much enthusiasm for that forensic analysis. And so to the extent that I can help as somebody on the outside, maybe who has friendly intentions to help push us towards some of those lessons, then I hope this podcast can move us a little bit in that direction. But right now I worry Afghanistan is being forgotten, and so are those lessons.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think I'm looking at this problem set with my own personal experiences, sort of like if you're looking at the elephant, I was standing at the very base of it, at the feet, encountered Afghanistan as a very junior officer, as a platoon leader in the 101st Airborne Division. You know, even before that, as a cadet, I remember being in the audience at West Point in December 2009 when President Obama announced the surge of forces to Afghanistan. So it was really a defining moment in the early part of my career. And also the challenges that I saw in Afghanistan really inspired me to want to continue to work in these kind of environments and to work with partner forces moving forward in my career.
Doug and Jay, you both suggested that we may not be having the debate or the kind of introspection on the conflict in Afghanistan that we should be as an army. Can you expand on that a little more?
You know, there's a congressionally mandated process that's in its early days, and it's a three-year project, bipartisan by design. They're just staffing up the commission now. It's unclear to me whether they'll have the funding stream required to actually do serious retrospection on this. And the fact that they're not even at work yet, and we're, you know, a year and a half after the fall of Kabul, I think goes to Jay's point that if we're not careful, we're just going to forget about this. And it's not clear to me how that effort, that lessons learned project, produces 3 years from now something that's going to grab everyone's attention. Meanwhile, inside the Department of Defense, there are public reports that there's an internal lessons learned project which made its way to the E-ring, so the executive corridors of the Pentagon, only to have its course reversed and sort of sent back to the authors for additional work. No one knows what's in there and how promising that might be, how revealing that might be. Will it be classified? Will it be unclassified? And then likewise, there's at least unofficial reports that there's a similar effort underway at the State Department. But remember that the American bureaucracies today, so whether it's the legislative branch or the executive branch, right, are consumed by the ongoing inbox, right? And the inbox today is not Afghanistan. The inbox today is Ukraine, the competition with China, climate, pandemics, and all these other issues. So I think Jay's initial point that, you know, there's a real hazard here that we might forget about this and just sort of assign it to the historians, you know, 10 years from now is a potential risk.
Just to echo what Doug said, I mean, I worry that Ukraine, understandably right now, is this blinding white light, and it's taking almost all attention of the administration, and that's not being devoted to China, right? And so more to the point, Ukraine looks like the kind of war that the U.S. Army wants to fight. This looks like a modern peer kind of competitor fight, and it doesn't look anything like Afghanistan, according to at least official records. I actually would disagree with that. I think there are parts of Afghanistan that you can see in Ukraine today. But I just worry that this is the kind of fight that the army wants to fight in the future. Afghanistan clearly is not. And part of this is, you know, that information and knowledge is perishable. And despite the fact that we have lots of records from Afghanistan, much of the data is still missing or incomplete. Personnel recollections of people's tours are going to diminish over time. And so I worry that there's a window now to start gathering this that isn't going to be open for that much longer, and maybe too long for these congressionally mandated investigations to actually take hold. So I just worry that we're in the process of forgetting now if we're not careful.
I know you're focusing here on impacts of Afghanistan on the army, but I think there are at least two categories of lessons or observations that apply across theaters, across services, and across conflict varieties, right? Everything from perhaps Afghanistan to full-fledged near competitors. One is strategic design. So the design of strategy. How do we design strategy so that we get the strategic effect we want? And I think this question of strategic architecture or framing applies no matter what the theater or what the challenge. And the other then is security force assistance or enabling partner forces. So look, even if there's a near-peer head-on-head competition, they're going to be, at least on the periphery of that face-to-face competition, partner forces that are also involved in the campaign and so forth. And there's a very rich opportunity to learn from our 20 years of security force assistance in Afghanistan. So I hope we get to those two in the course of the conversation today.
If you look at the last era of strategic competition, which was arguably the Cold War, a lot of the conflicts between the Soviet Union and the United States were actually fought out indirectly by supporting partner forces in different countries. So, you know, lessons on counterinsurgency and working with partner forces from Afghanistan. may become relevant even in a potential contest with Russia or China. But with that said, though, let's shift to our central question, which is, what lessons should the Army take from the war in Afghanistan? To organize the conversation, I'd like to start with strategic or policy level lessons, and then we can work down to operational or tactical lessons more specific to the Army. Doug, starting with you, when you look at the U.S. failure in Afghanistan, what factors do you primarily attribute it to?
Well, let me focus on this question of strategic design, or how do we actually craft a strategy? And my takeaway from my personal experience in Afghanistan, first as Central Command, then as the operations officer on the Joint Staff, and then 6 years in the White House, 4 years at NATO, is that we fundamentally did not well enough understand Afghanistan to craft an effective strategy. We learned Afghanistan as we went along. And after 20 years, we did accumulate some expertise in niche parts of the U.S. government. But by and large, from the outset, and well into the 20-year campaign, at the 10-year mark, for example, we were still discovery learning Afghanistan. And what do I mean by that? I mean, you can't design a strategy if you don't understand the texture of the problem. What are the politics? What are the economics? What are the security implications? What are the demographics? How does geography play a role? What about the regional context? You know, when we went to Afghanistan in 2001, it was the fourth poorest country in the world. That should have informed the level of ambition that we had for Afghanistan. When we went to Afghanistan in 2001, they were already coming out of a 20-year period of nonstop warfare. What was for us year one was for the Afghans year 21. And that should have informed what we took on. There was a 70% illiteracy rate when we went into Afghanistan in 2001. And then the neighborhood, I'm not sure there's a tougher neighborhood for any nation state in the world today than Afghanistan's neighborhood. So all of these factors should have informed the extent to which we started the strategic equation, right? Which begins with, what is it we want to achieve? And I think we underappreciated many of these underlying conditions, these factors, when we set out relatively early, by 2002 and 2003, very ambitious goals for ourselves. Then next in the strategic equation is, well, how are you going to achieve those goals, the ways? And my experience is that we should learn the lesson that we over-militarized the ways in which we approached Afghanistan. And this led to our military forces doing things that they weren't best equipped, organized, trained, and equipped to do, which is a lesson for the Army itself as the main service provider. But it often cast our forces, our diplomats, our intelligence officers into situations and roles for which they were not best fit. And then finally, our resources. The short history of our time in Afghanistan is that we often suffered a disconnect between what we aim to achieve and the resources we committed, an ends-means disconnect, if you will. Some of this is informed, of course, that several years into Afghanistan, we went to Iraq. And many of the military and intelligence and diplomatic resources that were needed in Afghanistan were prioritized, rather, to Iraq. That's a major contributor in terms of this ends-and-means disconnect. But we over-militarized our ways, we didn't sufficiently resource the means, and the result is that for many of the 20 years, I would argue most of the 20-year experience in Afghanistan, we were suffering from strategic disconnect and poor strategic design. And the root of that at the outset was insufficient expertise on Afghanistan. So if you're a strategist and you study strategy in its generic forms, this is a real case study for how to get it wrong.
I think it's a great point by the ambassador in terms of the strategic lessons of just being humble about what American power can accomplish, what American military power can accomplish, how determined our adversaries can be, regardless of the context. We know that Afghanistan was an incredibly difficult operational environment, incredibly difficult region, an incredibly difficult and determined and often, you know, single-mindedly determined opponent in the Taliban as well. And reflecting on, you know, amidst those conditions, as we look at future environments, future challenges that we face as a country, you know, what can we do, right? As we calibrate, we want that end state to be given that environment.
Just very quickly, so I agree with everything that's been said. I would add two more points. Just one on this notion of design. I think the United States Army, I think the U.S. itself, writ large, doesn't really understand how to design armies and or governments. And so you think of how incredibly ambitious this intervention was, right? Restructuring a form of government, restructuring an army on the fly in the fourth poorest country in the world, as Doug said. I don't think we have a good understanding of how to execute that. And so we're basically rebuilding the ship at sea as a war is unfolding, as an insurgency is unfolding. And so mistakes are made at the beginning that then compound as it goes further on. So the Afghan government that stood up is way too centralized. It's basically pushing out these incredibly ambitious ventures into the villages, displacing customary governance, for example, in the villages without really providing something in its place. Tons of aid go out, but raising expectations, but without a way to manage it or actually effectively allocate it. And then this effort to sort of go for a very small army, and then all of a sudden an incredibly large army almost overnight, and have all the problems of Afghanistan be imported inside the army. So on the design side, these are very tricky issues each by themselves. To have to do all of them together inside some kind of integrated strategy that's supposed to produce some kind of victory, a political victory, is exceedingly difficult. The second point I would just say very quickly is that I think the United States underestimated the Taliban, including its resiliency and its adaptation. And so over the course of the war, it changed how it fought. It changed how it governed in certain areas. It changed how it interfaced with the population. And it always seemed to do so in a way that the decision cycle was faster than what the United States could match. So it was innovating, it was experimenting in some ways, in a way that I think the U.S. Army couldn't actually compete with. I think it took a long time for the United States to figure out not only that it was an insurgency and to call it an insurgency, but that it was an incredibly capable and resilient actor. And I think that surprised a lot of people on the ground. And by the time it, you know, the strategy started to change to adapt to that, it was probably too late.
Not only did we fail to really understand the Taliban, we made an upfront strategic error in conflating the Taliban with Al-Qaeda, which for 20 years was the number one goal, the vital national interest at risk. But when we conflated the two, we jumped across sort of the logic barrier between what we needed to do to defeat Al-Qaeda and what we needed to do to defeat the Taliban. It became one and the same. And that was a challenge. You know, it strikes me just as I listen to our conversation today that some of this may be a Goldwater-Nichols design flaw, right? Because Goldwater-Nichols specifies that it's the combatant commanders, it's the joint forces who actually do strategic design. And the services, like the Army, our topic today, are simply force providers, right? They organize, train, and equip. So I think there may be a gap here between the ability of our professional military education system to train joint campaign or strategic design and the responsibility of the services to simply provide the resources. And I'm not sure we've got that right.
That kind of leaned into my follow-on question, which was whether this is a solvable issue. You know, if I understand correctly, a good design for Afghanistan required expertise about Afghanistan, which is probably a country that was not high on our radar before the invasion. So how would the U.S. Army or the military as a joint force today even set conditions for success in a conflict that we might not expect to arise in the next decade?
Well, look, it's understandable in the weeks after 9/11 that we launched a campaign in Afghanistan without fully understanding Afghanistan. For those of us who were in the government at that time or, you know, watching things carefully, we didn't appreciate at that time that 9/11 was a one-day event. You know, we imagined there were subsequent 9/11-like attacks that we might be subject to. So there was a rush to get to Afghanistan, displace the Taliban, attempt to bring Al-Qaeda to justice in those early weeks. Okay, so that's understandable. We can't have expertise globally about 190 countries in the world. Where I think we fell down is we failed to sustain focus on Afghanistan and continuity in personnel and command structures and so forth, which would have allowed us to accrue expertise over time. Rather, we rotated senior commanders. You know, last time I looked, maybe with the exception of Scotty Miller and Mick Nicholson, our last two commanders in Afghanistan, the average time for a four-star commander in Afghanistan across the 20-year experience was something like 13 months. Well, you don't learn Afghanistan in 13 months. That's discovery learning. And I know, Kyle, you and Sam have experience on the ground, and Jay as well. We rotated diplomats, intelligence officers, development experts, and military officers far too frequently to accumulate expertise. And then from inside the government, we imagined that we'd get most of our expertise from the intelligence community. There was too little outreach beyond the governmental boundaries, so to academics and so forth, who had long-time expertise, decades of expertise in Afghanistan. There was too little outreach from within the government to those outside experts. So there are a lot of things here we could have done differently.
Kyle, I think to your question too, of the point of, you know, we're not going to know where the next war is, where the next challenge is. I think that's always going to be true. We have a perfect record in getting it wrong, as former Secretary of Defense Gates used to quip. But, you know, so at the tactical and operational level, I think the most important thing you can ask for and train for and try to reinforce in doctrine is adaptability. Is there's going to be a delta between where you are and what the actual scenario and environment and enemy are going to be like. And it's just a question of which of those two sides can kind of close that gap the quickest is going to have that success.
I would totally agree with the need to build a bridge to the academics, given our topic of our podcast and the title of the podcast. You know, especially after 9/11, there was a lot of enthusiasm by social scientists, anthropologists to come and help and to try and figure out the war. And there wasn't that outreach. And there was a need for speed in that 2001 that didn't allow for the interaction or the ability to reach over to academics.
Jay, I'd like to build off of what you said about how practitioners and the military could have looked to scholars for assistance. And specifically, we can focus in on counterinsurgency. The key assumptions that inform counterinsurgency doctrine, or FM3-24, have been examined extensively within the social science literature by political scientists like you. And before we discuss how it actually played out on the ground, I'd like to start with an overview of what the logic is behind U.S. coin doctrine. Jay, you've published extensively on counterinsurgency theory. Can you provide the basic assumptions that underpin population-centric counterinsurgency, and what evidence from scholarship seems to support or not support these assumptions?
Sure. So information-centric or population-centric counterinsurgency boils down to a few simple premises. One, you need to win over the sympathy or support of the population towards the host nation or the external force coming in. And you do that by providing aid and services and the judicious use of violence to protect those populations who are going to be receiving those benefits. And the idea here is simply that if you give aid and goods in the requisite amount and you get the balance right, and well, put a pin in that and come back to it in a moment, but you can shift the population sympathy. And with that comes information. And you need to solve the identification problem if you're a counterinsurgent. You have to be able to find the insurgents who are hiding among the population. So what you need is the population to provide those tips, that information to you, so that you can then target the insurgency and do so in a much more selective or discriminate fashion, ideally avoiding civilian casualties. So the idea is that you set up this virtuous circle. You provide aid. You protect the population. They provide sympathy, support to the government, to you. They do so materially in the form of tips. You find the insurgency. You degrade the insurgents, either killing the leadership, arresting leadership, or convincing fighters to no longer fight in the insurgency. Then you become more precise. You provide more aid. You get better information. The population's more sympathetic. Again, you become more precise. And eventually, at some point, you will either dry up support for the insurgency or destroy it enough that it's either willing to come to the table for political negotiations or it's been destroyed entirely. That at least is how it's supposed to work in theory. But you asked, does the evidence support this in our literature? Most of our literature, I would argue now, is pretty skeptical of many of the assumptions that underpin counterinsurgency. And it's incredibly skeptical towards the role of aid in these settings. We do have a few studies that show in Iraq and Afghanistan that areas that got more aid often provided more tips than places that did not. But that's a small portion of the literature. Much of the literature now, particularly in Afghanistan, is very dubious that aid provides any kind of incentive for people to provide tips, that in fact aid can backfire, create corruption, generate incentives towards violence. And that oftentimes the counterinsurgent, even if it creates this space, is unable to capitalize on it politically. So that these very, very local results, and often only pertain in certain places, very safe places, for example, it doesn't really scale up politically to any kind of political solution to the war. And so counterinsurgency looks good in theory. This population-centric approach looks good in theory. It probably doesn't work very well in practice, at least according to much of our literature now.
You know, just last semester, I taught a course here at West Point on political violence and counterinsurgency, and this term, the identification problem, became an essential concept to understanding this form of conflict. Can you describe a little more what the identification problem is and why it matters so much?
Yeah, so identification problem is simply that, as Doug said, there's a problem of information. The population knows who the insurgents are because they're among them in a given village or town or something like that. The counterinsurgent, particularly if that counterinsurgent is from the outside, does not. It doesn't have the information or the ability to access the networks to be able to figure out who the insurgents are. The danger, if you can't find who the insurgents are, is that you're going to use violence indiscriminately. And if you start harming civilians, you will turn the population against you. So states need some way of solving this identification problem. And the population-centric approach is really about finding, it's almost a technocratic exercise in finding the right mix of violence and aid to get that population to help you solve the identification problem through the provision of information.
You know, I remember numerous visits with President Karzai through both the Bush administration period and into the Obama period. At every senior level visit to President Karzai, he would begin the conversation very politely, but he would bring out a 3x5 card. And on that 3x5 card were 3 points that he said were killing him politically among his political base, right? And this, of course, the Karzai government was the government we were trying to support, right, against the Taliban insurgency. His 3 points were civilian casualties, night raids, where we would go into an Afghan compound at night and typically make off with the male detainees, and then illegal detentions or unjustified detentions, our prison system. And to Jay's point, why did we revert to these 3 tactics that were destroying our relationship over time with Karzai? We did it because we weren't getting human intelligence, the tips, the reliable information on who was who on the battlefield. So we used what we tried to be as precise as possible. We were doing so with sort of secondhand sources. So image intelligence, you know, drone images and so forth. We were making assumptions about who was enemy and who was friendly. And often we got that wrong. And over time, I think those 3 factors greatly eroded Karzai's confidence in us. And over time, I think eroded our traction with the Afghan people.
And Kyle, I think at the tactical level, you know, the application of having some doctrine was helpful, right? Some idea for junior leaders of what to do was helpful. And I think that the application, the understanding, the success of this model varied widely, you know, based on areas. Even within, you know, the same province, you'd have, okay, this 1 or 2 districts or regions, is this thing, you know, seems to be working. And others where it's just not taking. You know, I'm reminded, you know, I was in Kunar in the northern part of the Main Valley. A couple of months ago, I finally read Wes Morgan's great book called The Hardest Place on the Pesh River Valley. And, you know, he has this great way of explaining, you know, in counterinsurgency, there's the ink spot theory, you know, the ink hits the paper and then a lot of ink spots and they're eventually going to connect. And, you know, from my own experience, I felt like where I was, things seem to be progressing as sort of we might expect, right? With great challenges, but as we might expect. And in the Pesh, that just was not the case. You know, he uses the analogy that instead of hitting paper, it was like the ink was, you know, hitting a plastic sheet. Like all the aid, all the effort, you know, all the engagements that were going into that area were just not taking, right? So I think understanding those environments and sort of the why, even at the tactical level, can be very challenging.
Sam, I second that Wes Morgan's book on Afghanistan is excellent for anybody trying to understand how counterinsurgency played out for tactical level units. My experience in Wardak province, which is just south of the capital Kabul during the surge, resembled much more ink hitting a plastic sheet. We were just, you know, we were able to strong point our outposts, but control never really spread beyond the range of our weapon systems. But I'd like to shift back to something you said, Doug, which is that the United States may have over-militarized our effort. I assume you're not talking about at the tactical level, as we were just discussing, but kind of the strategic level where we look at the balance between civilian and military roles in the conflict, specifically looking at, you know, advice for future Army soldiers who become engaged in a conflict where they have to work with civilians. What was it that led to this difficulty of over-militarizing the situation?
Well, a contributing factor was the absence of counterpart civilian officials. We could mobilize the military. Sam mentioned that he was in the audience December 2009 when President Obama announced his surge into Afghanistan, right? That's kind of a seminal event. It demonstrates that if the president decides, we can dispatch the army. And that resulted in 30,000 additional American troops flowing into Afghanistan, another 10,000 partner coalition troops surging into Afghanistan. That's what the military does. It's not what the State Department does. It's not what the intelligence services do. It's not what development professionals do. The ability to surge and change directions, to adapt, is mainly a military characteristic. So when there is a change in direction, a surge, or a change in strategic design, the military tends to be able to execute that change quickest and therefore get moving on this new direction in a way that its counterpart civilian organizations just don't have the capacity to do. And so therefore, the military flows into vacancies that are left by civilian under-resourcing and tries to do its best. Look, on the one hand, you can applaud this, right? I mean, these are the kind of military leaders we want. We don't want somebody who says, well, basically, I know this is essential, but that's not my job. Look, that's not going to cut it in any military organization. So you can applaud the fact that they try to fill this vacuum. The problem is they're not organized, trained, or equipped to do so. And what they tend to bring to these largely civilian tasks, like development or like assisting the stand-up of local governance, is their bias towards military organizational structures, military processes, and so forth. And over time, what happens is that the mission itself becomes over-militarized. This is especially true when you have such a resource asymmetry between the resources the military has, and even if the personnel are on hand, the resources that the State Department, USAID, and even the intelligence community have. We in the military overwhelm our counterpart organizations by way of resources. So there's a natural bias to turning to the military to get things done, both culturally, by way of organizational structure, and by way of resources. So it's somewhat understandable, but it's not helpful, especially in a counterinsurgency setting.
I would just add from my own experience that the USAID became in some ways overly militarized as well through its interaction with the military, in part because it relied on the military to access many of these areas and sort of the contractors. And so its mission, its mandate became much more stabilization driven over time to the point that, you know, 2012 to 2015, all of the programs being run were called stabilization of some kind or another. And it has really shifted away from its traditional focus into a much more security-based hearts and minds kind of stabilization initiative. And so when we're talking about hearts and minds, that flowed in part from the military, but it actually came into the civilian side as well. And one of the things I thought was particularly interesting in Afghanistan and particularly important is simply that there wasn't a huge amount of coordination between the army and the aid agencies on the ground. So everybody's running around out there doing a hearts and minds campaign. They're sometimes working across purposes in the same areas, but they're increasingly on the civilian side becoming much more securitized or militarized in the way that they think about metrics of success, where they think about their programming in the most dangerous places. And a lot of our evidence now suggests that the places you want to put aid and the only places it works are in the safe places. And so you have organizations like USAID and NGOs wanting to work in these sort of hotspots where the aid may actually be the least effective, but it's in part because they're being driven by the military. And again, you know, it's so resource heavy, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, that they want to be able to compete and play in that space too, that their mandates get shaped by what the army is doing as well.
You know, I'm reminded that as an admirable adaptation, organizational adaptation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we created PRTs, right? Provincial Reconstruction Teams. And these were small teams, mostly of Americans, but we had some organized by coalition partners. Among the 34 provinces in Afghanistan, one team per province. And the design was to connect that province to the central government, right? And do that by way of this small team of Americans who could tailor, who could target military, government, and development systems to that province. So it's kind of an interesting design, right? And yet when you go around and visit the PRTs, what you see are there's, you know, PRT of 12 or 15 people. Well, all but one or two are military officers. I mean, even by way of the manpower or person power inside the PRTs, we militarized our approach. And why is it? Well, it's because we didn't have State Department officials or USAID officials ready to run PRTs. So they became essentially small military outposts.
If over-militarizing is a concern, how can we prepare the military to not do this in the future? Is this a matter of training military leaders to self-restrain? Or is it literally just deploying less military resources so our go-getter military leaders just can't step in and fill these vacuums?
Well, the second effort won't work because if you deploy a squad of military guys or one ODA, they're going to try to do everything they can to achieve the mission. It's just the people we recruit. I mean, it's who we are. as a military, right? So turning the thicket down, probably won't work. I think it goes back to, ends, ways, and means. If we're going to take on a mission as ambitious as the one we designed for ourselves in Afghanistan, we have to take no shortcuts on strategic design. We have to drive that strategic design all the way through resources. And when we get to resources, if we don't have enough USAID officials, if we don't have enough diplomats, then the strategic mandate is to go back to the top of the equation and scale down what it is you're trying to achieve. And we didn't do that. We left ourselves with overly ambitious goals, and we struggled with insufficient resources the whole time. And the result of that, the factor that we're focused on here, is that the military tried to fill the gaps. So I think it goes back to our original point, Kyle, about strategic design.
For military leaders, land warfare professionals, junior leaders, the reality in the future is that pending sort of a radical recalculation of the funding of the State Department and also the culture of the State Department is not an expeditionary organization, right? It has the manning to man all the embassies, and outposts that it has. It does not have that, okay, this unit is in reserve, this unit is in reserve. I think the expectation on leaders is that you're probably going to face challenges that you would consider to be civilian challenges. You might be measured in a training environment on how successful you are at decisive action against a near peer, but you're going to face governance problems, infrastructure problems. You're going to be asked to do dispute resolution and deal with tribal and cultural leaders. Those realities are just going to stay the same. I think the last point that I'll make on this is risk tolerance. Another reason I think we see, look around at a tactical level and be like, where is, all these other organizations that we were promised is they're not trained and equipped to be in the places that you are. They don't have that same risk tolerance. I think we see that today, especially post Benghazi with the State Department. It's very difficult to do expeditionary diplomacy, whereas we're much more willing to put military leaders in these positions. But I think recognizing still that, we don't have the training and ability to really excel. And then, as Ambassador said, to sort of moderate our expectations and moderate what our goals are going to be, knowing that we don't have necessarily the capabilities to do everything we might want to do.
Another point playing on this theme is that we're not just talking about senior military officers that struggled with this. Counterinsurgency has been referred to as the graduate level of war. And the reason is because it's exceptionally complicated and difficult. And because of that, we also put a lot of weight on our junior soldiers. Some of the concepts that came out of Iraq and Afghanistan were the strategic corporal, the idea that every soldier is an intelligence sensor where we should kind of, expect them to watch and report things up. We also expected our soldiers of all ranks down to the junior level to become familiar with Afghan culture and language training. And on the other hand, we have units that are specifically organized, trained, and equipped for engagement and cultural nuance, such as the U.S. Army Special Forces units. Based on your observations, is it realistic to kind of put these expectations on our most junior soldiers?
Let me just start. The answer is no. I think it's unfair. And this is an issue for the Army. This podcast is focused increasingly on what can the Army take from the 20-year experience. One of the things is that we often miscast our units to tasks on the battlefield. So if we just look at sort of the advisor effort, for example, at the beginning of the war in 2001, there was only one type of unit in the U.S. Army structure that was designed to organize, train, and equip partner forces to do what became, actually changed names in midstream, right? But what became security force assistance, right? And that was John Kennedy's Green Berets. The Green Beret structure, the ODA teams, ODBs, and so forth, that started as an effort to partner with Vietnamese in the mid-1960s, right? They were, in 2001, the only organizational structure designed to work alongside partner forces, right? In fact, the structure of an ODA goes back to what's it take to advise a partner battalion. So that helped design the makeup of an ODA. And increasingly in Afghanistan, what we saw was that we went to other parts of the Army force structure to do security force assistance, and then we were disappointed with the results. By contrast, where ODAs focused, which was in Iraq on the Iraqi Special Forces and Afghanistan on the commandos, we actually got a damn good product, right? The system worked when we applied the right tool to the task. But when we went to conventional forces, and in some cases, even economized there, by going to reserve component conventional forces to train Afghan forces. We were disappointed with the results. I remember at one point on a visit to Afghanistan down in Kandahar saying, look, we've got an hour or so to burn here in the schedule of the visit. I'd like to see a MTT. I want to see a MIT team. And they said, okay, no problem. We'll go over here. And I met these guys, dozen guys, the same number as an ODA, and they were from the Missouri National Guard. You know, I asked them to come up down off their Humvees. Let's just talk for a few minutes. How much training did you get? Well, you know, not much. Have you ever done anything like this before? Oh, no, you know. Okay, which one of you 12 is the advisor to the Afghan battalion, your counterpart battalion's intel officer, to the S2, right? And, you know, sergeant raises his hands. I said, oh, that's great. Are you an intelligence specialist? No, I'm a supply sergeant, but I'm just filling a spot here. You know, and they were doing this on 6-month intervals. Look, training your partner security forces is the strategic theory of the case. That's the path to success. Then you can't economize on the resources provided. And that's not to say that conventional or National Guard teams were not doing their damnedest to achieve the mission, but they weren't organized, trained, and equipped to do so. And it wasn't until maybe 15 years into this campaign that we generated SFABs, Security Force Assistance Brigades. And frankly, it was so late in the program that I can't point to any significant change in success with SFABs. Now, maybe in future conflicts, their value will be revealed, but I think they came too little too late in Afghanistan. So we never applied the right tools. One last point, I don't want to be too preachy on this. Inside the special forces of the United States Army, I think we need a serious look at why we didn't commit larger proportion of our special forces to security force assistance and why so many of our special forces teams were committed to direct action and performing the kinds of missions that Karzai complained about. So night raids, detentions, and so forth. And it was almost as though we confused counterinsurgency and counterterrorism or conflated the two. And we forgot that what we really needed were capable Afghan forces.
I think putting partners first, you know, is really hard and it can be really frustrating. But if you don't have the mindset and the training to do so, you're not even going to know, you know, it's just a foreign environment. Like it's the same as if you're scuba diving or, you know, you're jumping out of an airplane, like all the stuff that you know and think you know about what's right and, you know, what's best with your training is just, it might not be right, right? It might not be best. But in terms of future environments, I think recognizing that we got to start with partners first and not have that be the afterthought. And I think, Kyle, some of your own research, you know, points to this challenge in the soft community, as well as conventional advisors. Our incentive structures designed for, hey, go to combat, right? Even if you have a partner, just take your partner, right? Bring them into contact with the enemy. I think, you know, seriously relooking what we value as an organization, right, in terms of how you progress your partner force, and also what we're asking SOF to do and at what scale they can do sustainably, right, given sort of the small numbers. So my, you know, research focused on the Village Stability Operations Program. And one of the challenges that that program faced was the pressure for results at a scale that, you know, with the small size of SOF could not produce. Right, of saying, you know, if you want to have 145 of these locations across the country, you're going to have to water down the product, right? You're going to have less monitoring. You might have to introduce conventional infantry battalions to uplift these SOF teams. And I think, you know, expectation management of what SOF can do for you at this scale, right? If you're talking about a light footprint campaign and, you know, your boots on the ground total in a country is going to be less than, you know, 1,000, 2,000, I think that's very sustainable for SOF. But asking American SOF to, hey, build a 100,000 person army, right? It's going to be beyond the skill and capabilities of the SOF that we have. And I think if we try to just scale up more in a future conflict, you're going to get a watered down product with other problems down the road.
For me, this conversation still kind of going around a central issue. So on the one hand, you asked, is it fair to ask a junior officer to be able to have language competencies and history and business sense and all the other things required to counterinsurgency? And I think the consensus is no, that's not fair, although they may be in that position. I think the deeper question in some ways is, does counterinsurgency actually work as practiced, right? So is it really just a question of resourcing and maybe getting the right people and a little bit of elbow grease and we can make this counterinsurgency engine run? Or is ultimately the strategy itself flawed? And if that's the case, then none of this is really going to matter too much to the actual outcomes that we care about. And so we have a little bit of a conversation here about partner and partner militaries. There's also just how do those junior officers interact with the civilian population and things like that. And I'm not so sure we struck upon a winning formula yet. And so I worry that the incentive, you know, this we're sort of like, well, we need more soft. We can double down on that and create more soft or something like that so they can train. We're still in the same box. We're just applying more resources, but we're still not getting the actual outcome that we care about.
Jay, I'd like to get back to this important point about the actual assumptions of U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine potentially being wrong, as well as what realistic objectives for future U.S. interventions might be. But before doing so, let's dig a little more into our experience working with partner forces in Afghanistan. Sam, you were right that my dissertation research, which is motivated by my own 20 months in Afghanistan as a junior infantry officer, finds that we had trouble putting our partners first. And it was not due to a lack of good intentions or trying to do the right thing by our soldiers at the tactical level. It's really just built in the incentive structures of being an infantry platoon based in Afghanistan. I'd like to talk about the lessons learned on working with partners, which I think is relevant because, you know, as Doug mentioned in the beginning, we can expect that we're going to work with partner forces through security force assistance around the world in the future. Right now, we're doing this in Ukraine, for example. And furthermore, you know, it's written into our national defense strategy, which emphasizes the role of allies and partners in strategic competition. So, you know, with that as a primer, looking at the specific lessons from Afghanistan, how effective were we at building partner capacity and working alongside our partner forces? What worked and what did not work?
Well, I think the model that worked was the focus by the Army Special Forces on commando counterparts in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So I know this is focused on Afghanistan today, but you know, the Afghan commandos were probably the best organized, trained, and equipped indigenous special operations forces, not only in Afghanistan, but in the region. And I would stack them up against almost anybody. And what you had there was a concerted, prolonged focus by the right tool, Army Green Berets, on the right target, Afghan commandos. And it really paid off. What did not work was when we wanted to generate those kinds of results at scale, and we applied resources in the form of conventional units to essentially mimic the soft model of security force assistance. And what we found was it's, you know, it's quite a unique and demanding skill set that conventional forces don't have on their mission essential task list. So we were asking them to do something for which they weren't really trained to do. As an interim solution, we came up with the notion that we would deploy conventional U.S. Army units alongside partner units, Afghan partner units, and we would sort of as a halfway house approach, Afghan units would partner with us and they'd see by way of example what right looks like in Army language, right? The problem there is that there was such a capability gap between what we were capable of doing and what the Afghans were capable of doing is that I don't think there was a lot of learning going on. And Kyle, to your point, and I think, as I understand it, reflects your personal experience. You know, when the American unit was given a mission and told, well, this should be a partner mission, the mission came first. Accomplishing the mission came first. And the result was too many of those missions were largely American missions, U.S. Army missions with a few Afghans who came along. And it got registered, it got tracked as a partner mission. But that was much more paperwork than it was in practice. So I don't think this notion of partnering works well. You know, a quick way to summarize this is that if you're playing basketball with Michael Jordan and your guys like the five of us, you get to take the ball out. Okay. And what do? You pass the ball to Michael. Okay. Because everybody wants to be like Mike. Well, the Afghans did a lot of sort of passing the ball to us, and we were the Michael Jordans of the battlefield.
In terms of what worked and what did not, I totally agree with Ambassador DeLute. You know, that sustained advising and partnership, the heel to toe, you know, one advisor unit works with one Afghan unit and then they are immediately replaced and you have that sustained contact, that sustained mentorship. You know, I think that includes, you know, what we would call AAA advising, you know, advised, assist, and accompany authorities to see, okay, we taught you all this stuff. right? You got it in this sort of open, empty field. Now let's go do it and see you struggle through it and be there to help you, right? Help you, you know, with sort of the golden parachute of, okay, we can provide fire support. We can provide medevac. So you can build confidence for going into these tough environments. I think that's something that we can take forward. We can take to different regions, you know, that model really does produce good results. I think what did not work, you know, both on the conventional and soft side, you know, ad hoc efforts. And I think one thing, you know, sort of the train and release model, I think we can discard that there's a role for someone has to provide basic training, obviously. But the idea that you can provide, you know, training in a static, safe environment, and then that force is trained and you don't need to touch them or see them again, I think is really problematic. And I think the final one would be training these forces and then just leaving them, right? Leaving them on sort of static defensive operations and thinking that they're going to continue to develop again without that sustained mentorship was a serious mistake.
I think we need to take into account the setting. This goes back to my point about understanding the conditions. You know, when you're building a partner security force like the Afghan National Security Forces, in the face of the kind of corruption that eroded the chain of command inside the Afghan security forces, and when you're building that force with a population base of largely illiterate recruits, and when among that force that you're building, you suffer for about 10 years, 30% attrition. And yes, you had some battlefield attrition, but you had overwhelming battlefield attrition where desertions and absentees and so forth, right? Those bigger conditions, these are conditions that persist outside the unit in question, the unit being trained, really narrow your chances for success because they're systemic conditions. So illiteracy, attrition, corruption, you know, a special forces team can't deal with those. Those are systemic and endemic. And when you're faced with those sorts of that sort of uphill climb, it may be actually insurmountable for successful security force systems.
I would just add more structural factor that I think dictated success of the various partner organizations. That's the ethnic composition of the units and how they related to the local populations. So there were a number of militia in the north, in Kunduz, for example, or the zero units in the east, which were spectacular failures, right? That they preyed upon the civilian population. They were not combat effective. And part of that had to do with the mix of people who were in those units, either the ethnic or the tribal composition, and how they responded to the local populations. And I think one of the big questions is, what do you do with ethnic diversity when you're trying to build these units? Do you want to have people drawn from the local area and then potentially politicize a fault line of which they're going to exploit through violence? Or do you want to try and blend units together from a variety of different people, derived different regions to try and sort of break those local ties, but thereby maybe erode the information advantages that those groups would have had? And so many of the places the United States is thinking about partner organizations or partnerships is going to be marked by ethnic diversity. And I don't know if we have a good answer yet to how we handle this in these particular units, but we did see tremendous success in the commandos, which were integrated and inclusive units. And we saw a lot of militia who were mono-ethnic or mono-tribal, and they took revenge on local populations that were not of the same group. And so these internal dynamics that we're stepping into, again, are structural. We may not be able to deal with them very much, but through our recruitment strategies, through the manpower strategies and how we actually build these units, we might be able to curb some of the worst excesses if we're careful.
Yeah, Jay, your book, Divided Armies, you know, this is kind of the premise of that book. And as I read your book, which I do think is important for military practitioners, what stuck out to me was that to have the detailed knowledge of the ethnic composition of your partner force and then shape a building partner capacity plan based on that is, again, a theme we keep coming to, extremely complex and something that's probably hard to make up on the fly. And yet, nonetheless, it's a reality on the ground that we might have to learn how to address in future conflicts. Jay's book, Divided Armies, is worth a podcast on its own, I suspect. And I'm aware that we're running long on time right now, so I'd like to pivot to closing comments. The last theme I'd like to touch on is, how can the United States Army and the military at large prepare to address future challenges based on what we learned in Afghanistan?
Well, the first thing would be to actually learn from Afghanistan and Iraq, right? I mean, the Army has come upon this term, lessons learned, but there are lessons that should be learned there are very many fewer lessons that are actually learned. And what do I mean by learned? By learned, I'd like to see an organizational adaptation of some sort. So a change in training, a change in doctrine, a change in organizations. And as we've discussed earlier today, you know, the only noticeable change in organizational structure that we saw across the 20 years was the creation of security force assistance brigades. And frankly, they were too little too late. And it's even to this day, I'm not sure that the so-called SFAB adaptation will actually take hold organizationally. You know, will conventional soldiers who go into security force assistance brigades stay there long enough and be rewarded for their service just as they would if they were in a conventional army structure? I think the voting's still out on that. So it's one thing to collect lessons to be learned. It's quite another for an organization like the Army to actually adapt and show some evidence that they've learned them. So I think the jury's still out.
Alongside those organizational changes, and if we had like our magic wand to try and make these lessons learned into some kind of actual concrete policy, I would love to see the Army embrace an experimentalist mindset. So there's often this mentality of, well, we have to find the right solution. Often you only learn that through failure. And one of the biggest problems I have in Afghanistan and thinking through lessons learned is that many times programs, policies fail, but we don't know why. And it's in part because we didn't collect the requisite data or the requisite information to be able to make the assessments. And oftentimes, because the units are there for such a short period of time, there isn't this learning. There also isn't this sort of organizational learning. And so part of what I'd love to see is this mindset that says we're in a tough environment. We need to be adaptable. We're going to try lots of different things on the ground. We're going to experiment, but we're going to collect the data, to collect the requisite kind of information to know why things are failing and why they're not, to sort of shorten up this learning curve so that we're not 15 years into the war and we're still kind of doing the same things and we haven't really learned. And just to put one example on that, so the United States spent between $3 and $4 billion on SERP money, Commander's Emergency Response Program funding for Afghanistan, right? Tiny little grants all over, or money outlays across Afghanistan to try and win hearts and minds and to tamp down the violence. When we go to look and say, did this actually work? Much of the data we would need to actually assess this question is missing, right? So like I worked on some of this data back in 2009, 2010, most of the places where the SERP money was spent didn't have a latitude and longitude coordinate to show where it actually was spent. So you were looking at billions of dollars in a spreadsheet, and you couldn't actually figure what had happened because much of the data was missing. This is a huge signature piece of your strategy that you don't know what's happening on the ground. And so part of this is just, I know it's wonky, but this is the part of the name of the podcast, so I'm going to go with the social science piece, right? Is thinking about how do we learn and how do we do it in near real time? And part of that is collect the data, right? Think about how we would assess stuff. Think about experimentation in a deliberate sense, not kind of every unit out for themselves, but actually an orchestrated strategy to figure out why stuff is working and not. We're not going to get another 15-year learning curve in the next conflict, right? Because the insurgents, wherever this is going to be, will have learned from the Taliban example, right? They're paying attention to that as well. And so if you think you're going to go into another conflict with this huge run-up, you're not going to have it. And so I think it's alongside Doug's organizational changes, I would like an organizational mentality or mindset change to embrace this experimentation.
Jay, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other conflicts in the post-9/11 era have provided some data for social scientists to learn about counterinsurgency and civil war. If scholars are increasingly skeptical that population-centric counterinsurgency works, what are the competing theories out there that are getting some traction?
I mean, there's a little bit on light touch interventions, right? Heavy use of soft teams and things like that to go in, but no regular forces, no heavy footprint. There's also now over the horizon type strategies, right? Where you're going to rely on technology to try and degrade insurgents through signals intelligence and drones. But if I characterize the literature now, a lot of it is don't do these interventions at all. That there isn't necessarily a winning strategy that we just haven't hit upon yet. Light touch are flawed. These heavy-handed ones like Afghanistan or Iraq are also flawed, and that these are just very, very hard things to do in very tough places with very high failure rates. So I think part of what the reflection is, and this is building on some of the work by Alex Downs in his new book, Catastrophic Success, is the best course of action might not be doing anything at all. That the U.S. is not built to do this. The structural conditions are just so high that the chances of failing are so high that you shouldn't try at all.
Well, I guess that depends what your objectives are in the first place, which we don't always have clear answers to. You know, sometimes I wonder if a light touch with light returns is okay. If our objectives were minimal in the first place, you know, such as just containing some terrorist threat or deterring an attack on the U.S., which, you know, is a decision for policymakers.
I mean, I think that's right. You know, it depends what you want to do. If you want to dry up support for an insurgency and put a democracy in place, well, you know, you can't really do that with a light touch. If your idea is to manage violence, right, to keep sort of a lid on it so it doesn't spread, then a light touch coupled with drones or over the horizon, maybe that is a solution. So you're right. It all depends on the political question of like, what do you want to actually achieve with this intervention? I think some of the literature now suggests that the answer of a heavy-handed intervention doesn't really have a lot of place. There aren't that many places where it would be a viable answer to that political question. But you're right. It depends on what you want to do.
You know, I think it's interesting. Since our experience in Afghanistan, we've had two subsequent vignettes, right? We had the counter-Islamic State model in northern Iraq and northern Syria, which was much lighter in terms of footprint. And now we have the ongoing assistance to the Ukrainians. And I think it'd be useful for the Army to take on a significant study that lays out the spectrum of possibilities from, you know, 140,000 Western troops in building a nation state in Afghanistan to counter ISIS as another model to the kind of assistance we're providing the Ukrainians. So that, you know, we've got sort of a range of possibilities here, which could then inform, if those are different ways of doing this, right, could then inform the strategic design up front. But of course, in the case of Afghanistan, that initial strategic design was very heavily influenced by the weeks after 9/11 and the conflating of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all of that. So there is a way to sort of structure this in a helpful way so that in the future, we have more than one choice.
I think as we're doing that strategic design, I think we should take away from the Afghanistan experience two core takeaways to Jay's point about being humble about our capabilities. We know that we're not trained, designed, organized, and equipped for these environments. And typically these problems occur in places where we're not ready for them, right? That they don't have the human infrastructure, the physical infrastructure. You know, the adjacent countries, the environment is not conducive, you know, to our success and recognizing those limitations. And then the second one, I think, to echo Ambassador Liu's point, would be to question those core assumptions, right? Like, what is the nature of the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, right? And interrogate those core assumptions at the root of these strategic choices. And I think this is a problem, you know, that manifests itself from working in Africa, right? This is a question that we have to ask ourselves consistently, right? Is what is the relationship of pick your affiliate organization to its core, right? How much of a threat does this specific organization, right, pose to U.S. interests? So I think those are two things that we can take away.
You know, Sam, I've tried in the course of this conversation today to focus on expertise. Right? That these kinds of campaigns have to be founded on sufficient understanding of the underlying conditions so that you have some chance of success. But you've raised a couple times this question of humility, and that's the equal and opposite counterpart of expertise, right? So we should never get to the point where we think we're so expert about something as foreign as Afghanistan or any number of other places we might fight that we edge towards hubris. And the counterpart, the insurance against hubris, is humility. So I applaud the fact that several times now you've mentioned this notion of humility and just being humble about what we can accomplish on what kind of timelines and at what cost.
Gentlemen, sadly, we have run out of time. Lieutenant General Doug Loop, Professor Jay Lyall, and Major Sam Wilkins, thank you for sharing your research and experience with the Social Science of War podcast. I learned a ton from the conversation.
Thank you, Kyle.
Thanks, Kyle.
Same here. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Season 1, Episode 4 of the Social Science of War podcast, brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We release a new episode every 2 weeks. In our next episode, I discuss the ways that the Army and the broader military are employed around the world to exert influence and build partnerships with retired Brigadier General Kim Field, who is the current J5 at SOCOM, Dr. Brian Blankenship from the University of Miami, and Major Kyle Wolfley. Following episodes, we'll examine implications from the politicization of the military, operational lessons from the war in Ukraine for the Army, the role of the Army in proxy conflicts, and more. If you liked today's episode, please like and leave a positive comment on your favorite podcast platform and share The Social Science of War with other scholars and Army professionals. And one last note, what you heard today were the views of the participants and do not represent those of West Point, the Army, or any agency of the U.S. government. Thank you again for listening, and we will see you next time.